Welcome to the podcast. We're here today with Doris Kearns Goodwin, the award-winning historian. Her latest book, The Bully Pulpit, tells the fascinating intertwined stories of Presidents Teddy Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the birth of the journalists who had come to proudly call themselves muckrakers. Welcome, Doris.
Thank you, Steve. I'm so glad that you're doing this, though. It's great.
Your book covers a fascinating period of American history, an era of truly remarkable ferment. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with some of those events, set the stage for us. What were the big issues when President McKinley was assassinated and the vice president, 42-year-old Teddy Roosevelt, suddenly found himself in the Oval Office? What was before him?
Well, before him was what they call now the Gilded Age, which means that essentially from the time of the Civil War to 1901 or 1902, there had grown a whole new economy in America, people moving from the country to the city, huge corporations swallowing up littler businesses, ordinary people feeling squeezed, very few, if any, regulations of factory life, unsanitary conditions in meatpacking plants. The whole laissez-faire philosophy was almost like a religious conviction that government shouldn't do anything to help with people who were being offset by the changes in the economy. So there was a lot of turbulence at that time. The unions were striking in violent strikes. People were losing coal in the winters when there were strikes. And it was a very tumultuous, that turned out to be a productive period once the progressives get underway. But at the turn, there was a sense of possibly even a revolution against what was going on.
Yeah, you point out in an earlier portion of the book, the march of Coxey's army into Washington in the 1890s. And one of the members of Congress says there should be no help for the unemployed from the government because, after all, being unemployed is an act of God.
Right, and that's what they believed. In fact, one of the coal barons also said, you have to trust us, you know, because we are God's servants, the business guys. So there was a whole argument that had to be made that government had a role in the economic life and the social life of the country, and that's really what Roosevelt began to undertake.
Now, just to back up a little bit, your book, of course, is structured around a series of fantastic biographical sketches of the leading figures of this era. So let's talk a little bit about Teddy Roosevelt, who, you know, we certainly know as a conservationist, as a Rough Rider, but I think perhaps people are not as aware of his close relationship with reporters. How did that come about? How did he become so sort of captivated by and interested with the work of journalism?
Well, I think part of it is that he was a writer himself, and he just respected good writing. I mean, he said he slaved over his writing, although he eventually writes 40 books, quite a few of which are just distinguished. But I think it really began when he was in the state legislature, when he's only in his 20s, right after college, and he tries to get certain things through the legislature and realizes he can't, unless he can mobilize the pressure from the outside in, because the people in charge at that time of the New York State Legislature were the political bosses that he was fighting and who wanted none of the kind of legislation, even the little progressive legislation he wanted. So there were a whole group of reporters in Albany. He became friendly with them. And then when he was governor, he needed them again. And then when he was president, a whole new set of them. But he recognized that they were the channel to the public, and without the public pressure, he couldn't get through what he wanted to.
You sketch a remarkable scene when he's New York City police commissioner, and there's a sort of suggestion, which turned out to be true, that the New York City police force was entirely corrupt, that places on it were for sale to the highest bidder. And so he decides to go out at night with a cop reporter.
That's exactly right. I mean, Lincoln Steffens, who becomes one of the McClure's, the magazine that I focus on, main writers, he and Jacob Riis told him, you have to get out and see the conditions of what's going on at night with the police force. So he went out in disguise with a floppy hat and a long coat on. And if he caught policemen who were not doing their duty, who were having lunch or dinner, rather, you know, late-night diners, or he went into the houses of the tenements and he saw what they were like on a hot night, and then he brought that knowledge back to him, brought those errant policemen into the police commissioner's office the next morning. But that also became a routine for him through the rest of his presidency. Get out from wherever you are, try and see what's actually happening, figure out the source of corruption, and just hit it hard once you find it.
Now, you mentioned just a moment ago McClure's magazine, which occupies a major and important part of your book. As a journalist myself, it sounds almost like a journalistic heaven. You have a famous editor, Samuel Sidney McClure, who seems to love his reporters and give them both the time and space to go out and find things. How revolutionary was what McClure was doing when he started his magazine?
Well, what it seems is two things made it really revolutionary. One was he decided to gather the best reporters he could find and give them really generous salaries as staffs. He claimed he invented the idea of the staff reporter so that they just weren't paid by what they turned in, by rather they would be paid month by month by month, which meant that they could spend, if they needed to, a year and a half or 2 years on their articles without writing a word until they finally came out. And then they'd come out in 10, 12, 15-part series month after month, and the country would gobble them up. But I think the other thing he did was he just had such an eye for talent. So beside Lincoln Steffens, who is taught in journalism school, as you know now, because of his great autobiography and the work he did on the political corruption of the cities, you have the great Ida Tarbell writing about Standard Oil, later about the tariff. Ray Baker, who I fell in love with. There was something about him that was just an extraordinary reporter, considered one of the best reporters of his age, who studied the unions and the railroad abuses. And then William Allen White, the Emporia, Kansas reporter, country editor, whose works are quoted all over the country. And they were such comrades. They had a sense of connection to one another. They stayed at each other's houses. I think it probably was probably the most fun time to be a journalist if you're going to be one.
Now, you have a marvelous quote from the editor, Sam McClure. He says, "The vitality of democracy depends on popular knowledge of complex questions." To what extent do you feel, reviewing their work, that they achieved that or that they moved the conversation?
I mean, I really think they did. From what you can tell from the letters that go to the editors, from the editorial columns, not just the sale of the magazine, and then their connection with Theodore Roosevelt. So he has his own bully pulpit. He knows how to explain complex things simply. But on the other hand, once they wrote their stories, for example, Ida Tarbell, once she writes the story of how John D. Rockefeller had used unfair and illegal means to create the Standard Oil octopus, then her story becomes something that can be used by the politicians and by Teddy to illustrate. He had said before that the idea of trusts and monopolies was kind of abstract. It was hard to get the people to pay attention. But once the full story, they knew how to write narratively. In fact, that's what Sam McClure said, the story is the thing. So he would tear apart their things unless it made a story, and then it did have an impact on the public in conjunction with Roosevelt's incredible ability to shorthand everything, you know, speak softly, carry a big stick, square deal, even gave Maxwell House the slogan, good to the very last drop. So together, there's no question, I think, that they pressured the Congress, who would have bottled up these bills, once they got to the floor, they had to pass them because the public demanded it.
Now, one thing I noticed in reading your book was that the relationship between reporters who cover the White House and the president was very different than I think we're accustomed to today. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, I noticed one thing in particular where he even gives Lincoln Steffens a handwritten note that he can show to government officials as he makes his rounds saying, you know, the undersigned person, Lincoln Steffens, is working, you know, at my behest, you know, tell him anything you want to know about the running of government, signed Teddy Roosevelt. Boy, I wish I had one of those when I started in Washington.
I know. It is inconceivable today. I mean, I think what happened in that case is that Steffens had done such a good job uprooting corruption in cities and then states. I mean, so well done that, you know, that mayors were thrown out, people went to jail, new reform governors and reform mayors came in. So Teddy Roosevelt feeling, I don't have anything to hide. If there's corruption here in the federal government, I want it found. And that should be the attitude, you know, of a leader who's on top of an organization where inevitably there's going to be problems at other levels of it. Even at another time, he made a deal with Ray Baker. He was investigating a water project, and he was afraid that there might be something wrong there. He asked him for all of his information so he could find out. In that case, it turned out there wasn't something wrong. But at least he then knew that the rumors he were hearing were wrong. But it just meant that he had to have confidence. He had to know that if they criticized him, he could get through it because he had such a relationship to the public. And he would argue with them, tell them their remedies were impractical. So it depended on that integrity on both sides being maintained, which it somehow magically was.
Although you do describe a moment that I think most of us in today's journalism would kind of blanch at, which is the president having argued with Ray Baker, I believe it was, then is writing a speech and decides he wants to see the proof of the article, and then he shows him, the reporter, the speech he's writing.
even more than that. It's the message to the Congress, which is like our annual State of the Unions, right? Yeah, I can't imagine that happening today, except that he wanted his prior criticism before he gave the message, because it was on the very subject that he felt Ray Baker, railroad regulation, knew more about than he did. And then interestingly, though, again showing that integrity can be maintained, Ray Baker criticizes really that what Roosevelt had written was nowhere near sufficient to the problem, and Roosevelt writes him back saying, you're wrong, you don't understand. Actually, he changes his mind and includes in the paragraph the part that Ray Baker had written.
Now, as time goes forward, I think it's clear from the book that Roosevelt remains quite close to these reporters at McClure's, but all kinds of imitators spring up who are not as good. And at one point, he coins a term that sort of today is understood one way, but I think then was understood another, which is muckraker. What did Roosevelt mean when he called people muckrakers?
You know, at the time, what happened is, even though, just exactly as you say, he told the people who were at McClure's, I don't mean you, he was worried that because McClure's had become profitable and was so well talked about and was an important magazine, a lot of other magazines decided, oh, we need our own investigative reporters. We're going to do the same thing. But they didn't necessarily get the research time. They produced articles that were against what was going on, but sometimes against people with factual base that was thin. And Roosevelt was worried that too many people were just trying to rake up muck, which is what John Bunyan had talked about in terms of people that just look down at the bottom. They don't look up at the sky. It's what's good. And he feared that a real revolutionary fervor was being created almost towards socialism again. So he coined the phrase muckraker. And then, of course, as you say, later it's a badge of honor and should be, because it meant essentially investigative reporting to find out what's wrong. But he just meant it to not let people go too far without the factual base at the time.
Although it sounds, from the way you write about the period, that perhaps Roosevelt had a point, because you suggest that at a certain juncture, not too many years hence, there comes a time when there's a kind of national fatigue about all the scandals. There's so much investigative reporting and so many, you know, bad guys in business and government and the unions that people sort of become tired of it and inured to it.
No, I think that is correct. It makes you feel like maybe the country has an attention span for a certain period of time where they get all roused up and they love the idea that we're finding out what's wrong. But then after a while, they just felt, it can't be this bad everywhere. Nobody's going to want to go into public life. What are we going to do in government if everything seems wrong, or go into business? And Roosevelt had an instinctive sense of where the country was at. So I think before these guys understood it, he saw that they were going too much, too often. They better write about what's good about America as well as what's bad about America.
Now, when you turn to Taft, it's clear that he maybe doesn't have that kind of golden gut that Roosevelt does, but yet he seems in some ways to have been, in the end, more effective than the more instinctive, pugnacious Roosevelt. Why was that?
Well, I think what happened is that, and he would be the first to admit it, that Roosevelt had laid the foundation so that he had already educated the country, for example, as to the need for antitrust regulation and antitrust legislation and suits. And so then some of these suits had started in Roosevelt's time, and they came to fruition in Taft's mind and Taft's time. And they did actually then institute even more suits during Taft's time, but it's because it had already started. And similarly, Roosevelt had started withdrawing lands from private exploitation to create public lands, and yet he did it by executive action rather than laws, because he couldn't get the laws through. Taft very slowly got the laws through, got criticized in the middle, but did eventually get the Congress approval to withdraw this land. So it was partly that Roosevelt started a crusade, and then Taft was able to put it into laws when he came in his much more deliberate, slow, not public way.
I must say, reading your book, which I really enjoyed, I saw many, many echoes between the politics of today and those of the Progressive Era. You have these massive companies, which you could analogize to the big, too big to fail banks. You have government regulators who are seemingly overwhelmed, a legislature divided over whether laissez-faire is the best approach. From your perspective, having spent a significant amount of time studying this period, where do you see the similarities and where do you see the most salient differences?
Well, the thing that I think the problems are rather similar, surprisingly, I mean, the Gilded Age, has returned in many ways. There is this huge gap between the rich and the poor, which was first really noticed in 1900. You do have these big organizations swallowing up littler ones. Then the question is, where is the response to it? And is the press today and the politicians today ready to make the kind of progressive response? And to be honest, I was so happy when I thought about coming on this with you, because I think ProPublica is a modern equivalent, trying to do what they did back then, maybe with more resources back then, maybe with a country that had a greater attention span, so they were willing to read these long reports. But nevertheless, it's what's important, because so much of the press is entertainment value now. And even when you get a president making a bully pulpit speech like Teddy Roosevelt might have, trying to mobilize the country, as we saw President Obama doing with gun control, or even now with explaining the health care, breaking news comes in, the next subject is up, you know, and people are criticizing the speech even before it's even delivered. I think it's harder to get through to the public today to get them to act. But the necessity for it, I think, is still there, just as it was in 1900.
Well, that's very well put. I mean, I, again, struck as I am being the editor here at ProPublica by this notion that we're trying to deliver popular knowledge of complex questions, but it is challenging. I think in the current internet environment, a great story on these kinds of subjects can get attention, but the competition feels much more difficult than perhaps it was for McClure's.
I think that's right. I mean, the internet gives you a forum, you know, that obviously has a much wider reach than McClure's magazine, which sold 400,000 copies, right? So that's the great thing about today. But then so many other people have a bully pulpit today now, too. It could be a blogger, or it could be, you know, a person of one political persuasion, or it might be one cable channel versus another. So to sort out, we have much more stuff in our heads today, much more information, but to sort out what's really true and based on really good reporting, and then how to use that to get something done, I think the whole process is more complicated today.
Do you have a sense that this national fatigue of scandals is something that has stayed with us today?
You know, it's possible that it has. You know, there may be just this innate desire to want to believe that so many things can't be wrong. And so I think it's really important that what's written is just so impregnable, to use the word I did before, that you really have to believe it, you know, that even if you don't want to, because you think people are exaggerating things, and there is a lot of exaggeration going on today, and in political campaigns, you can't believe half of what either side says. So that trust, I think, in information, just as trust in government has been reduced, trust in Congress is reduced, trust in the press is reduced now, too. So I think that's why it's so important that these things be gold standard, and so you can't turn your head away from it in a certain sense.
Well, it certainly seems as if McClure was pioneering that kind of thinking and reporting. I mean, I'm struck with the accounts of work of Ida Tarbell and so on, that, you know, she went to depositions, she went to court documents, she went to original sources. I mean, this was very different from, say, the pamphleteering of the 18th century.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the important thing to realize about this whole period, which is that you're coming out from the 18th and the 19th century, where most of the press was partisan press, even through Lincoln's time. You know, if you're a Republican, you're a Whig, you're a Democrat, you're just reading your party newspaper, and the facts could be wildly different in one versus the other. In one, the Republican paper, Lincoln makes a great speech, he's carried out on the shoulders of the people. In the Democratic one, he falls on the floor, and they're booing and they're hissing. So finally, at the turn of the 20th century, you're getting national newspapers, national magazines, and they do have a forum. But then even still, you get someone like Ida, whose own father had been destroyed in some ways by John D. Rockefeller coming in. He had an independent oil company before John D. Rockefeller came in, and their family suffered. But she went to enormous lengths to try and make sure she saw the other side, so she wasn't just going after what had hurt her. And that objectivity, even though at some point she went over the edge, still, even looking today, it's a pretty decent piece of work. And that's amazing so many years later.
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, author of The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, thank you very much for joining us today at the podcast. It's a book I would certainly commend to all of our listeners. Anyone who's fascinated with investigative reporting and interested in ProPublica can learn a lot from this book.
Oh, thank you, Steve. I'm so glad to have been with you.
My pleasure.